From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Saturday night, in a packed Seminole County, Florida courtroom, George Zimmerman learned his fate for shooting Trayvon Martin.
State of Florida versus George Zimmerman. Verdict, we the jury find George Zimmerman not guilty.
The neighborhood watch captain was found not guilty of second-degree murder or the lesser charge of manslaughter. He is now a free man. The trial itself was often riveting, but it was the national debate around Zimmerman's motives, the action and character of the boy he shot, that really grabbed the nation's attention. This hour On Point, unpacking the Zimmerman verdict. You can join us, listeners, on air or online. Did the jury get it right or not? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me first today from Lake Mary, Florida, is Yamiche Alcindor. She's been covering the Zimmerman trial for USA Today. Yamiche, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
So you were there when the verdict was read on Saturday night. Take us into the courtroom. Describe that moment.
I really think you could feel this verdict when it was read, because it was such an emotional moment. You had the jury that wasn't on TV, but I could see, and their faces were very concerned. One juror looked really upset, and of course you could feel the relief of the Zimmerman family. Zimmerman's wife, Shelley, began to cry and started hugging his family, and you could just see that in her whole body that there was relaxation going on. And then on the other side of the aisle, you had the attorneys for Trayvon Martin's family, and they were really disappointed, and you could see it in their face that they were disappointed, and they rushed out of the courtroom as soon as they could, as soon as it was in recess, and you could just feel the two sides. It was almost like fog, almost. The feelings were just so thick.
And what about Zimmerman himself, his demeanor? I know you've been watching it throughout the trial. What was your read on him at the verdict?
I think he was just elated. He had really not shown any emotion at all. And as soon as the verdict was read, he kind of really just relaxed. And then after court was over was when the real emotion started showing. He started shaking hands and smiling. And you could see that was the most emotion he had shown really throughout the whole five-week trial.
After the verdict this weekend, of course, there were mostly peaceful crowds gathering around the U.S. And then here's some sound from Miami, a protest of the acquittal of George Zimmerman.
No justice! No justice!
What has been the reaction generally, Yamiche? And, of course, President Obama weighed in today as well.
I can talk about here in Sanford, Florida.
Okay.
Here in Sanford, Florida, there were protesters outside or demonstrators outside the courthouse who started crying on one side and who were very happy on the other side. After the verdict, I started driving around Sanford just trying to figure out what was going on in the city. And the park where all the demonstrations had been held was empty. There was no one there. And in the black neighborhood of Goldsboro, where people really had led this movement and have a memorial dedicated to Trayvon Martin, people were outside, not as anywhere as rowdy as the rest of the country, but talking about this in heated discussions. And one woman I interviewed burst into tears as she talked about Trayvon Martin while standing in front of the memorial for him.
I was struck by the post-verdict press conference and the demeanor of the Florida Special Prosecutor Angela Corey. I'm curious what you were hearing and seeing off camera about how the prosecution responded to the verdict.
I mean, I think the prosecution was still very adamant that they thought George Zimmerman was guilty. And I think that in some ways, not just, I think I've talked to at least one attorney, but to be honest, I've talked to at least one attorney who said that he felt a little concerned about the fact that they said, yes, we respect the verdict of the jury, but they also seemed concerned that the jury maybe made the wrong decision, and what that means to the rest of the country when you have a lawyer kind of questioning the verdict of a jury. But they did seem very disappointed. So it could have, I'm not a lawyer, but it could have just been that they were disappointed and that they were just, you know, acting the way you would act if you lost such a big case.
President Obama, his statement today, a written statement, reads, "I know passions may be running high, but we are a nation of laws, and a jury has spoken." I'm curious, Yamiche, what were the key moments in the trial to your mind that you think led to this verdict of not guilty?
I think sitting in the courtroom, as well as my conversations with experts who watched it, I think the idea that there were just so many questions that were not answered, there was, this would happen in a really dark place. There were no eyewitnesses. So I think when you had one eyewitness saying George Zimmerman was on top and another one saying Trayvon Martin, and that was hard. Then you had these two families, everyone saying, one person saying, or one, not actually nine people saying it was George Zimmerman screaming on the 911 tape, three people saying it was Trayvon Martin. And the idea that there were just so many questions in terms of what really happened. I don't think anybody ever presented to the jury what they thought really happened.
Yamiche Alcindor has been covering this trial for USA Today. She joins me from Lake Mary, Florida. Yamiche, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joining me now from New York is Jelani Cobb. He teaches history at the University of Connecticut and is director of the Institute for African-American Studies there. He's also a contributor to TheNewYorker.com and has been writing about the Trayvon Martin George Zimmerman case for the magazine, which you can find by going to our website, onpointradio.org. Jelani, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
Also joining me from West Palm Beach, Florida, is Stacey Cole Ibera. She's an attorney at the Gunster Law Firm in West Palm Beach and is a former statewide prosecutor and assistant state attorney. Stacey, glad to have you with us as well.
Thank you. Hello, Jane.
Stacey, let me start with you. Were you surprised by the verdict?
I wasn't surprised by the verdict. Based on what I had seen and also the presentations that were given in the closing arguments, I do believe that the facts that were presented in the courtroom, it made it very difficult for the jury to be able to find that he was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, given what the elements that they had to review and make the decision on.
So did the prosecution overreach in this case? Did they set the bar too high for a second-degree murder charge?
I think that it was very difficult, given the facts that they had, to be able to get a verdict for a second degree. I think there was also a bit of the jury instructions themselves are very difficult to understand and to reach. And so I think it would have been beneficial to be able to go through and to be able to explain how the facts meet the elements of each of the crimes.
Here is Chief Prosecutor Bernie De La Rionda in his closing argument on Thursday of last week.
Why does this defendant get out of the car if he thinks that Trayvon Martin is a threat to him? Why? Why? Because he's got a gun. He's got the equalizer.
And here's Prosecutor De La Rionda laying blame on Zimmerman's assumptions in closing arguments, also on Thursday.
A teenager is dead. He is dead through no fault of his own. He is dead because another man made assumptions.
And on Friday, the defense attorney for George Zimmerman, Mark O'Mara, used a diagram to explain to the jury that they needed to be absolutely sure that Zimmerman did not act in self-defense for them to arrive at a guilty verdict.
The state needs to convince you all the way down here. Self-defense likely, it's a reasonable doubt as to self-defense. The self-defense suspected. Well, you have a reasonable doubt as to self-defense. Not guilty. May not be self-defense. You're not quite sure. Not guilty.
Stacey Cole Ibera, this really did not come down to some peculiarity in Florida law. It came down to basic self-defense, didn't it?
Correct. And it also came down to the basics of every trial, which is, do the facts meet the elements of a crime?
And so the bottom line, if someone fears they're in great bodily harm, it's the prosecution's burden, basically, to disprove self-defense. It comes down to reasonable doubt, correct?
Correct. And it makes it extremely hard when you have to sort of prove that double negative. You have to prove that it wasn't something, and then that it was beyond a reasonable doubt that it wasn't something. So Florida, it defines reasonable doubt not by what it is, but by what it is not. So even the instruction of a reasonable doubt becomes difficult in itself. So that's why I think that it's important that you spend a lot of time going through the actual jury instructions, because that's what's going to go back with the jury automatically. The jury will go back with those jury instructions, and that's what they're going to have in front of them. And so you want them to realize, okay, here are the jury instructions, but here are how the facts fit each of those instructions. Here's how we've met our burden and to go through. But there was a lot of emotions and a lot of asking the questions why, rather than saying this is how we have met our burden.
Jelani Cobb, what was your reaction, your response to the verdict?
Well, I mean, it's difficult to talk about this. purely in legal terms. Because if we're talking about reasonable doubt, I think it's impossible to remove that, you know, from the context of history, from the context of Florida, you know, from the context of who Trayvon Martin was and what initially led George Zimmerman to say that a person who had committed no crime and who was in the course of doing, you know, nothing more nefarious than procuring snacks should be profiled and should be followed and should he should get out of his car and pursue him, and that it's legal to do so with a weapon. And so the point that we get to, in order for this to become a trial about George Zimmerman's self-defense, we have to bypass the possibility that this was ever about Trayvon Martin's self-defense. And so it is completely reasonable for him to have you know, seen someone following him, for him, according to all accounts, that of Rachel Gentile and that of George Zimmerman, for him to have moved quickly away from Mr. Zimmerman and then wind up in a conflict and lose his life. And so in order for this to become a matter of self-defense, we have to forego the possibility that Trayvon Martin might have thought his own life was in jeopardy and that Mrs. Zimmerman might have precipitated the situation in which, you know, the conflict even begins.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the not guilty verdict in the George Zimmerman trial. Speaking with ABC News in an interview that aired yesterday, George Zimmerman's attorney, Marco Maris, said that even though the jury ruled not guilty, Zimmerman's life will never be secure again.
He will never be able to just walk down the street and not worry about who's looking at him or who's walking up behind him.
Zimmerman's attorney, Mark O'Mara, also said that Zimmerman will have the gun that killed Trey Martin returned to him.
Does he get that gun back?
Yes, he does.
How do you think he feels about guns now?
I think that he feels truly in his heart that if he did not have that weapon that night, he might not be here.
So do you think he would, if he could, he would carry a gun again?
Yes. Even more of a reason now, isn't there? A lot more people out there who actually hate him, though they shouldn't.
So you're saying he needs to protect himself?
Yes.
And the way to do it is by carrying a weapon?
It's one way.
My guest this hour is Stacey Cole Ibarra, an attorney in West Palm Beach, Florida. She's a former statewide prosecutor and assistant state attorney. We're also speaking with Jelani Cobb, contributor to TheNewYorker.com and professor of history and the director of the Institute for African American Studies at the University of Connecticut. Mr. Cobb, let me ask you about the role of race in this trial. What was it, and are there new racial wounds, do you think, that need to be addressed and even healed after this verdict?
Mm-hmm. I think that what's most disturbing is that there are not new racial wounds that come out of this. I think that this is just a confirmation of the existence of a wound that's been in the, there for some time. It's been there for decades. It's been there for centuries. And so very many people believe that it's a contradiction in terms for a black person to have a right to self-defense. And that's a reality. And the best evidence of that is the way that Trayvon Martin's identity was just savaged. People kind of made him into this menacing individual. And it obviated the fact that he had done nothing wrong. I think that's what we have to bear in mind here. And so, I don't think that there's anything new about this. I don't think that the verdict tells us necessarily anything that we didn't already know. But it confirms, I think, the most cynical assessments of where we are racially. And that just could happen at a point where there's a great deal of political empowerment among African Americans, where there is, you know, an African American in the White House.
You look online and you can see anywhere you turn so many comments about this issue of race as it relates to the trial. Stacey Cole Ibarra, I mean, reading just a few, if you want to kill someone in America and avoid jail time, make sure you kill a young black man. Another one, only white life is protected in America. Another one, now you all know that a black child's life is not worth much in America. I mean, talk about this issue of race and the argument that many African Americans are making that the justice system is simply stacked against them.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I understand. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Stacey. You first.
I was going to say that the courtroom is not the place for these types of debates. If certainly these social issues and the discussions absolutely need to be had, but they shouldn't be answered, or they shouldn't be looking for answers to come from a jury verdict. The legislature is a place for change, not the courtroom. And in the courtroom, that jury had a specific job to do, and that was to make a decision based on the facts that were presented in the courtroom, not all the issues that were surrounding it in terms of racial issues, gun control, self-defense. They were tasked with the specific limited job of listening to the facts that were admitted into the courtroom, the admissible evidence, and based on what was admitted, answering the question of, do those facts meet the elements of the crime beyond into the exclusion of every reasonable doubt? That is it. They were not supposed to make any considerations as to anything else. As a matter of fact, there are cautionary instructions that the judge reads to them, and they indicate that they are not supposed to come to a conclusion based on any sympathies or specifically an actual rule that was given to the jury in this case is, this case must not be decided for or against anyone because you feel sorry for anyone or angry at anyone.
And yet, let me play this sound from Rachel Gentile. She recounted her final phone conversation with Trayvon Martin, her longtime friend. She's on the stand here. She's being cross-examined and explaining that Martin told her on the phone, in his last few words, these things. This is from ABC News.
Describing the person that was watching him and following him, sir.
Describing the person is what made you think it was racial?
Yes.
And that's because he described him as a creepy-ass cracker?
Yes.
So it was racial, but it was because Trayvon Martin put race in this?
No.
You don't think that's a racial comment?
No.
You don't think that creepy-ass cracker is a racial comment?
No.
Let's get a call to this point. Carl is in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Carl. Welcome to On Point. Carl, are you there? All right. We'll try to get him back. Jaleel Cobb, was race inserted into this trial, do you think, at any point?
Yes, but I just want to respond to the previous comment. We can't behave as if courts are not a reflection of the broader society. And we also can't behave as if there's a uniform standard for what constitutes reasonable doubt. The fact of the matter is that six people, were a small referendum on, these facts and that were presented, but they were not given this information in isolation. That's why, we saw the image that Attorney O'Mara presented of Trayvon Martin. You know, the last thing they saw was the image he presented of them, of him as a young person, with showing his tattoos and with his shirt off and so on, which was really meant to bring home the fact that, wouldn't you be afraid of this person? And we can't behave as if courts don't reflect the prejudices of society, as if this is some sort of objective standard. Even the prosecutor, Bernie de la Rianda, said that our court system is not perfect. And, moreover, on the matter of race, Rachel Gentile was actually right. The fact that Trayvon Martin referred to him by the, creepy-ass cracker term, and she said she didn't see that as racial, Trayvon Martin also referred to George Zimmerman by the N-word. And so, and clearly he was not referring to him as a person of African descent. The fact of the matter is, and because I work with young people and interact with a number of young people across different backgrounds, is that whether we like it or not, epithets are often used as pronouns now. This is how kind of contemporary language is. And so, we've heard people refer to white people by the N-word, mm-hmm. heard people refer to people in all sorts of different ways, and so mm-hmm. that's absolutely what that was. Finally, someone who works in the court system, there's one democratic element about the court system is that you meet a lot of different types of people. Mark O'Mara certainly knows that this is how language is used. And certainly the prosecution knows that this is how language is used. Rachel Gentile was not the first person to use colloquial English to find themselves in the Seminole County Courthouse.
All right, let's get another call on this point. Sam is in Natick, Massachusetts. Hi, Sam. Welcome. You're on.
Hi. I have a question. My question is this. What is shameful about the whole situation is the fact that both sides, defense and the plaintiff team, both agree that there's elements of racism, and racism does still exist in this country. As a black man who came into this country, went through 12 years of college education, from pharmacy school to medical school to school of public health to school of management to law school. This is something that is very disturbing and troubling.
Still pervasive now, within the culture, Sam, is that what you're saying?
That's correct. And my question again, which is most important confounding variable here, is who is paying for the defense fund of Zimmerman?
I think that's another question. We'll get to that, Sam. I appreciate your call. Stacey Cole Ibera, let's wrap this up, this race question, and respond to the caller and to Jelani Cobb's comments, and then we'll move on.
Just, again, in terms of whether or not race is an aspect with this particular trial, I think that, again, the facts of this case, not the bigger issues that people are concerned with and are trying to wrestle with and to resolve, but the facts of this case were that there were young black boys that were breaking into the neighborhood. And that's a fact that was created before Trayvon Martin decided to just go and get his snacks. That was something that can't be ignored that was occurring. And that is what also George Zimmerman was responding to. And had it been different, that if they were young white boys and there was somebody that Zimmerman had seen looking suspicious and looking around and looking as if he was trying to see if somebody was watching him, same issues would be addressed.
But this is an unarmed kid at 8 o'clock at night. This is not 2 o'clock in the morning. This is 8 o'clock at night walking unarmed. I mean, there he was.
What you just did was describe the essence of racism, to say that if one person of a racial category has done something, then isn't justifiable to behave as if you can apply that blanket application to all people of that racial background.
No,
we would never think that, despite the fact that the majority of these school shootings, these mass school shootings that have been committed by young white men, we would not say that we should blanketly apply that. As a matter of fact, when we look at the very real history of racism in this country, and the fact that very many millions of white people went along with the system that oppressed and exploited black people, we still say that it's wrong to simply look at a white person and make the prima facie assumption that that person is racist.
Jelani, let me jump in here and get another caller in on this point. Nashville, Tennessee, James is on the line. James, go ahead. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, for me, I believe this is the whole issue is an issue of poorly trained security guards. And this is a community, a gated community. I've lived in gated communities like this where the security guards are overzealous. They lack community-based training, relational training, and they make the people who live there feel like prisoners. It's no wonder that Trayvon Martin reacted the way he did. You walk around the community and you're questioned, and, you know, I'm white, and I've been questioned, pulled over, you know, do you live here? What are you doing walking around here? Trayvon Martin was first identified as a shady character with a hoodie, not that he was black, but that he was carrying something, and that there's been a number of break-ins in this community, and this guy's walking around in the middle of the dark. He's got something in his hand. And it wasn't until the police officers asked, what race is he? That's when it became an issue.
Correct, and that was the issue of observing what somebody who appeared that they didn't belong, not because of their race, but because of their actions. And that is what the
actions were walking down the street.
The actions were described by Mr. Zimmerman specifically from his call. This guy it's raining and he's walking around looking about, and he's saying that the way that he was acting, the way that he was looking about.
Let's talk about the prosecution and where they actually maybe veered from the path to success. Prosecution narrative changed, did it not, Stacey Cole Ibera? I mean, once Trayvon was on top, but then he wasn't. He was on the bottom. I mean, they didn't seem to drive a consistent, plausible storyline throughout this case. Would you agree with that?
I do, and I believe that that's what makes it extremely difficult when you have to argue the case that that you've met your burden beyond a reasonable doubt when you've now switched sort of what you're presenting. But as prosecutors, you don't make your facts. You have the facts as they come out in the trial. Regardless of what you expect them to be before you go into trial, it's only what they say on the stand and what you're left with once the trial has sort of gone forward, and then you have to sort of roll with it. But it absolutely made it difficult when you're sort of switching theories right in front of the jury, when you're telling them that you expect them to see one thing, and then all of a sudden you're now arguing something different.
Here's Joe in Melbourne, Florida. Hi, Joe. Glad you called. You're on. Go ahead.
Thank you. I'll preface my remarks by stating that while I believe Mr. Zimmerman was guilty, the prosecution absolutely failed to emphasize to the jury that under the statute, from what I understand, Mr. Zimmerman failed to retreat in the face of potential danger, and in fact, he ignored the directive of the dispatcher. No honest juror could avoid reasonable doubt when the initial moment of contact between the two occurred, and as much as I would have liked to have seen Mr. Zimmerman found guilty of manslaughter, Florida prosecutors have now overcharged two high-profile cases, Casey Anthony and Mr. Zimmerman, both charged with murder without the necessary evidence available. We read yesterday that one of the IT people alleges that someone in the prosecution failed to provide the defense with all the photographs. I don't know where that's going. With regard to race, I accept that any immature, insecure, wannabe off cop would have questioned the presence of someone that didn't subscribe to the makeup of that neighborhood. The judge did the right thing by allowing profiling without the word racial. Finally, as one of your experts there stated, I've worked with gang members for several years, and I understand that words that reflect racially charged hate to some don't necessarily apply in the nomenclature and semantics of many of the young people, regardless of their race. I hope the real issue is going to be the stand your ground law, the fact that if I get angry driving down the highway at someone, I chase them down. They respond by fear to me. I pull out my gun and I shoot them. The law has to be fully examined. And I hope that the NAACP and a lot of other groups will get behind changes and adjustments to the law. And thank you for the time.
Joe, thank you very much. Jelani,
go ahead and just... Actually, the jury instruction that was read to the jurors in this case is that if George Zimmerman was not engaged in an unlawful activity and was attacked in any place where he had a right to be, he had no duty to retreat and had the right to stand his ground and meet force with force, including deadly force, if he reasonably believed that it was necessary to do so to prevent death or great bodily harm to himself or another, or to prevent the commission of a forcible felony.
So here's what this becomes transparently racial. You know, if the shoe was on the other foot, if George Zimmerman is being pursued by a black man who's armed at night, whom he does not know, who has not identified him as any official capacity, or in Mrs. Zimmerman's case, semi-official capacity as a neighborhood watch person, and he were to be involved in a conflict that ultimately took his life, there'd be no doubt that this constituted a crime. People would say that Mr. Zimmerman had the right to fear for his life if some person is following him and lurking around in the dark, following him in the rain and by car and then by foot. And so, this is how if Mr. Zimmerman doesn't get out of the car, then we don't wind up with this conflict. As for the makeup of that community is 20% black. And so for the African-Americans who moved there, they're now struck with the terrible paradox of moving to a gated community in order to be safe from crime and having to fear both crime and people who will only see you as the embodiment of it.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the not guilty verdict and the George Zimmerman trial and the big national takeaway from this case. Here's some sound from Friday. In his closing argument, defense attorney Mark O'Mara said that Trayvon Martin was not unarmed because he had a sidewalk and a cement as a weapon.
That's cement. That is a sidewalk. And that is not an unarmed teenager with nothing but Skittles trying to get home. That was somebody who used the availability of dangerous items from his fist to the concrete to cause great bodily injury.
My guest this hour is Stacey Cole Ibarra, an attorney in West Palm Beach, and Jelani Kahn, professor of history at the University of Connecticut and a contributor to TheNewYorker.com. I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation now. Joining me from New York is David Folkenfleck, media correspondent for NPR. David, welcome to you.
Hey, Jane. Thanks so much.
Thanks for being here. How did you see the media's role in this case?
I think it was integral to this case. I mean, as we say so often these days, you know, it's careful to disentangle what we mean by the media. I think if you think about social media, it was vital to the ability of advocates for the Martin family to raise the profile of the death of their son, and also to, in a sense, create pressure on authorities in Florida to pursue that case. It was picked up by people in the media, including, you know, this sort of overlap in the Venn diagram between advocacy and media. People like the Reverend Al Sharpton over on MSNBC, who was sort of playing a role in front of the cameras and as well as behind the host desk in his show on that cable network. And you saw that, you know, social media kind of influenced the media, which picked up that there was actually a story with overlays of racial tension, with overlays of question of gun ownership rights and gun ownership responsibilities. And then the mainstream media became engaged. It became national. You saw the president pick it up. So I don't think this case really goes to trial in quite the same way, and certainly not with the same profile, if the media hadn't been sort of monitoring what was happening on social media to decide that they would upgrade it into a more national story.
Jelani Kahn, do you agree with that? How do you see that point?
Well, absolutely. I think that you know, at every point, you know, social media was integral to, you know, the way that this conversation was had. Last spring, I went to a rally. I got a text message or a tweet about a rally that was being held in Union Square, downtown Manhattan. And so I got there, and there were thousands of people who were, you know, there in hoodies, you know, in solidarity with, you know, Tracy Martin and Sabrina Fulton. And so the fact that this could happen in New York, you know, on the other side of the country, and that there were people in San Francisco and people in L.A. and Chicago and D.C. and St. Louis that were all having this coordinated effort to, you know, express their solidarity with the family that had just under most horrific and unnecessary circumstances lost their child. That was all about social media, and I think it did have a great deal of influence on how we understood it, and the fact that this became an important story in the first place. Mm.
David Folkenfleck, there was gavel-to-gavel coverage of this trial, but it wasn't just cable channels giving this case a lot of play. Was this just a ratings bonanza, or was there something else here?
I think we can say yes to all of the above. I think certainly for cable news channels, certainly CNN seeking to find its voice under its new leader, Jeff Zucker, has embraced it wholeheartedly as a story. A colleague of mine, a contributor to NPR, Eric Deggans, who's also the media critic for the Tampa Bay Times, you know, made the point that this is a trial is an event that has breaking news on a fairly regular schedule. And for some an entity like cable news, it's a way of saying, look, we can talk about serious issues, but we can also have this burst of adrenaline saying, my God, we think there's going to be another development here. You know, I think we can't underestimate the point when it comes to television of how important it is that there were cameras present. Cameras are prevalent in many state courts, but if you think about a couple of really important court cases that happened in federal courts over the last week or so, think of, you know, Army Private Bradley Manning, who handed all those secrets over to WikiLeaks that were posted online that can convulsed the nation and particularly the national security community. That got very little coverage on television. Some, it is true, but very little because there are no cameras in the courtroom. Similarly, there in Boston, you've got the Whitey Bulger case playing out in federal court. How dramatic have the articles in the Globe and other papers been about that? There certainly has been some credible stories on television, on NPR, but not to the same degree because microphones and cameras simply aren't allowed in the federal courtroom there either. I think that a lot of it's a question of when you know, the guy who drops his keys in the street at night, you know, he's looking under where the streetlight shows illuminates as opposed to where his keys might have actually fallen. I think there's a question about whether or not the nation needed to spend this amount of its real estate of news attention on this trial, even as I think there are some very real questions about the specifics of the case and some implications for the case as well.
Let's get a call in here. Greg is in Iowa City, Iowa. Greg, welcome to On Point. Hello.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My comment is I've paid fairly close attention to the trial and all of the media attention afterward. You know, in the voir dire process, when both the prosecution and the defense went through the jury selection, they went painstakingly to pick the most honest and non-biased juries or jurors they possibly could. The minute that the verdict came in, not guilty, every single news organization essentially went to the point that this was a guilty person that got away. When did we as a society go away from the jury had all the information and made a possible correct decision? I know it's horrible to think that a 17-year-old could have done something that would contribute to his own death, but it is possible in this case that the jury got it correct and that Trayvon Martin did have some culpability in his own death.
Greg, thank you. Stacey Cole-Ibera, would you respond to that? Stacey, what about the jury in this case?
What's important to note is that the peremptory challenge had not been used or exhausted on either side. So both the defense and the state had the opportunity to strike a juror still if they did not feel that it was either going to give the state a fair trial or the defense a fair trial. So the jury that was set was agreed upon by both the state and the defense. A not guilty verdict can mean one of two things. It can mean that either, one, that the jury may think that he is guilty, however, the state did not prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt, or it can mean that they do believe that Mr. Zimmerman had acted in self-defense that day and that he was not guilty because he is innocent. It is, and only they would know based on the fact that they reached the decision. So There are things that have to occur here, which, again, the law has to be followed, and the facts that came out in the courtroom have to make the determination as to whether or not the elements were met. And the truth of the matter is that the way that the evidence was presented, no one really knows what occurred between the encounter between Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman at the time that the gunshot was fired, other than what was presented in the courtroom. And the way that it was presented gave the jury the ability to say that there was reasonable doubt.
Can I respond to this?
Certainly.
To the caller, I think in an ideal world, lawyers are seeking to get the most impartial jurors. I think in the world that we live in, lawyers are seeking to find the jurors that will be most likely to vote the way that they want them to vote in their own favor. That's why there's a booming industry of jury consultancy to find out how you can get people on a jury that are going to give you the highest likelihood of winning your case. Beyond that, I find it among the most disturbing things in this entire conversation is this theme of saying that Trayvon Martin had some culpability in his own death. He had no weapon. And to say that he was armed with the sidewalk is essentially arguing that a black man is armed any time he walks down a paved street. I suppose we're supposed to be telling our children now to only walk on grass, lest we be shot and then be accused of menacing someone with, our capacity to use pavement or to weaponize pavement. It's really disgusting that we have to have this conversation, that we have to have the conversation in this way. And regarding the point, I think, there's one thing that I will say that I agree about is that, yes, the jury might well have said, according to the facts that they were presented, they didn't find the case sufficient. However, we can't pretend that juries are not influenced by racial dynamics in society. There's been study after study showing that when we have wrongful convictions, especially as the Innocence Project has found again, overwhelmingly white juries are one common denominator in them. And so they do not look at black defendants in the same way that they look at white defendants. They tend to give white defendants shorter sentences when the offender is black, when they have a chance to weigh in on what the sentence should be.
David Folkenflik, let me let you jump in here. How did you see the race issue being covered in the media, would you say?
I think it was covered in different ways. I think that you saw some deep dives by some major publications, some interesting takes from various point of view publications as well. And that was interesting. You saw some debates on television that sort of devolved into, talking points on either side. And you saw occasionally some rather nuanced thing. CNN had a special in which they explored the use of the N-word as a result of this case, and I guess the Paula Deen episode as well, in which it was you know, it was done in response to a very heart-rending incident, and yet at the same time, it was not done as a sharp clash or a shout fest. I think it was up and down the conversation, and I think it's at times a little exhausting to have it when we're only having it at moments of tumult. And you know, the question is whether we're listening to each other at that moment. But this is the way in which at times the modern media hangs its hat on a peg to explore a larger issue that it won't draw its attention to, as we all have our attentions diverted a thousand myriad ways by Twitter and Facebook and our own shortened attention span. And yet when something comes up, we say, okay, well, this is the moment at which we need to explore this, and that's how we do it. And in some ways, that's useful, even as the episode itself is tragic. To think it through, but it's not always the most contemplative moment at which to work through it.
Here's Stephanie in Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Stephanie. I'm glad you waited. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I am just calling to first say that I support the jury decision because I support our judicial system, but I do recognize the emotion tied to the case as a Black woman. And as a Black American, I mean, it is difficult to put in words, but there is a difference. You are treated differently, and even in corporate America, that is true. So I expect that to be also true on our streets, and it's just unfortunate that the incident happened because it divides the country, and that's the last thing that we need to happen.
Stephanie, thank you very much. Let me ask you this question, panel. What's next for George Zimmerman? The NCAA and some members of Congress are calling for additional charges from the Justice Department. There's possibly a civil suit by the Trayvon Martin family. What's next for George Zimmerman? Stacey Colibera, from a legal perspective?
From a legal perspective, it's going to be difficult with regards to federal charges. They have a sort of internal policy called the Pettit policy that following a state prosecution, there should be no federal prosecution unless there's a compelling federal interest. And also they would have to have the hurdle of under the color of law that George Zimmerman was using a power given to him by a government agency. And with both of those in play, it would be extremely difficult to have the charges brought federally. Certainly, they do have the option of pursuing a civil case where the burden is lesser. However, they still have the ability here in Florida to argue civilly the stand your ground, where that decision would have to be made with a judge in determination of whether or not George Zimmerman had the ability to stand his ground.
Jelani Cobb, is there a will, do you think, in the Justice Department to push for this? The NAACP, of course, has been, as have many others. What's your take on it?
I don't know if they will. I'm skeptical that they will, and I don't know that they should, quite honestly, because to the extent that we focus on George Zimmerman, I think we lose sight of bigger issues here. That really, the most disturbing thing is that, if Stacey is actually correct, that the jury did vote in accord with the laws, which means that we've created a set of laws that come just shy of endorsing vigilantism. And so when we have this gray area like this, and we have the racial dynamics that are what they are, the result will be predictably what we saw on Saturday. And so that has to be the fight. That has to be the concern. This has to be, the issue of what we will allow private citizens to do and what actually is within the realm of law enforcement. And so I think, perhaps in the most cynical and perhaps accurate assessment of this is that in the kind of small government zeal that we've seen, take root across the country in years, we've now actually applied that even to police forces. So now we want the private citizens, we want homeschooling for children, we want private citizens to be able to police people, particularly if we're talking about African Americans. Those are the things that I'm concerned about. I think that we saw what happened with George Zimmerman. We should really focus more on state legislatures and dealing with what actually the implications of these laws are.
Stacey, quickly, what does this case mean for the future of Florida Stand Your Ground law, do you think?
It certainly is raising discussions, and that's what you would hope would happen in terms of a case like this, rather than looking to the verdict to come up with any solutions or any answers to questions for the discussions to be had and for the changes to take place in the legislation if that's where it is to occur. But getting back into conversation that were earlier is that when Mr. Cobb had mentioned about, you know, the comments about walking into the grass and things like that. Actually, the way that the law reads for justifiable use of deadly force, the danger, and this was an instruction that was read, the danger facing George Zimmerman need not have been actual. So the fact is whether or not Trayvon Martin was armed or not armed is not an issue that a jury is to consider when they are making that decision as to whether or not self-defense was used. It is the appearance of danger must have been so real that a reasonably cautious and prudent person under the same circumstances would have believed that the danger could only be avoided through use of that force. And that's, in summing up this case, the facts that were presented, it just was unclear what was happening at that time.
And David Fulkenflik, I'll give you the last word here on this whole case. Your takeaway?
My takeaway, a painful case. You know, it's a case where people were bound to be disappointed. It's going to be ultimately spent as a topic, although it'll tail off here on television and other places, you know, in part because it was a weak legal case, but it was one that was in response to an actual event. And, you're hearing quietly a little bit, or at least I'm hearing from colleagues, that at times some civil rights leaders, black civil rights leaders, are saying, at least we wanted to get the trial and have that shown. And this media, I will say, certainly gave that full ventilation in public view.
Well, thank you, panel, for a very interesting and enlightening hour. I appreciate it. We'll hear more, I'm sure. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.